today about the developments on the ground and other more recent ones. And she joins us now from Italy. Francesca Albanese, thank you so much for speaking to us on Real Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Francesca, I want to start off with a recent UN report that was put out. You know, Israel's facing new accusations that it's been torturing Palestinians in Israeli prisons. This recent report that I'm referring to says that, or found that 53 Palestinians died in Israeli custody since the 7th of October. It also found that Palestinian prisoners faced multiple forms of torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, starvation, electric shocks, the release of threatening dogs, and sexual violence. I know that you also released a report in June 2023 about the conditions of Israeli prisons in the occupied West Bank, but I do want to ask, what did you make of this recent report?
Three comments. First of all, I'm glad that finally there are organizations, reputable organizations reporting on this, because it's a huge issue. And I think what has been unveiled in the OHCHR report and others, which I will mention in a second, is the tip of the iceberg in the sense that I've been receiving information and conducting small investigations out of lack of capacity and difficulty to reach the informed people and the victims since January, February. And there have been reports from Israeli and Palestinian human rights organizations since then. There should have been greater attention to it. The second comment is what OHCHR has produced is a harrowing report on our reality that is to be read in context. On the one hand, there is a system which has been in place forever. And this is why, as soon as I became a special rapporteur, I decided to investigate the system to arrest and detain Palestinians, which had brought to Israeli jails nearly 1 million Palestinians over 57 years of occupation. And so the system was already there. A recent report by B'Tselem spoke of an organized policy to abuse, humiliate, inflict torment and torture Palestinians since October 7th. And it's a form of sadism and revenge exerted toward the Palestinians as such, the Palestinians as Palestinians. And the third element is that we are talking of unspeakable crimes that should be prosecuted by the International Criminal Court. And despite this, the silence among Western leaders is appalling. So, I mean, the idea that I have is the same, that Israel is de facto untouchable in the international community, including in the face of abominable crimes against defenseless and until they're proven guilty, innocent civilians.
Sorry, that last part, you were saying Israel's untouchable, because I couldn't hear it properly.
Yes, I said Israel is de facto untouchable in international community. The tide has changed. I think that the reputational damage that Israel has done to itself is irredeemable, but it will take time to adjust the realpolitik and create political resolve to hold Israel accountable. This is my two cents based on my experience, particularly my experience as a special rapporteur. People, including in the diplomatic community, know exactly what Israel is doing and why it's doing what it's doing, and still they will not move a finger.
Back to report, I want to ask, I mean, have you come across similar testimonies in from your experience and in your position?
Yes, I've received harrowing information and testimonies, both by family members who had seen their beloved ones, tortured in front of their eyes and executed on the spot in Gaza. But I've also received the information by lawyers in operating who had been able to access prisoners that or from organizations who had been able to access to visit prisons about the appalling conditions. And the comments I've heard from various people who have entered these prisons as the situation was bad before October 7, but now it's unspeakable. And there is, again, this sense of taking revenge, exact revenge from each and every Palestinian who's in Israeli custody.
You think that's the framing that should be viewed through, that it's taking revenge at Palestinians who are in Israeli custody?
In a way, I think, yes, because every Palestinian has been punished as a Palestinian. As President of Israel, Herzog, said himself, it's a nation which is responsible for what has happened on October 7. And I think that this has been the prevailing sentiment among many Israelis operating in the occupation forces. They have lifted all restraint that used to be there. I mean, the widespread recourse to sexual assaults against men, women, older persons, to an extent minors, absolutely unprecedented. And I can tell you, because I've studied the abuses that have taken place over the years in Israeli detention system attentively, and I cannot say that torture was systematic nowadays.
This reminds me of a recent incident, which I'm sure you've heard about, when the nine Israeli soldiers were arrested on suspicion of raping a Palestinian detainee. And the direct aftermath of that was the riot that we've seen and the far right protests, as well as some Israeli MPs or members of the Knesset who stormed the facility, the Sdei Tamen. And even the finance minister, Smotrich, he called the soldiers heroic warriors. I mean, what did you make of this incident?
Look, there is also another face to this story. I hear from Israeli colleagues and friends that this story of the rape of Palestinian inmates has sent shockwaves across the Israeli society. So there is a sentiment of revolt and disgust for what is being done against Palestinians deprived of their liberty. And at the same time, these aside, along with what you just said, meaning there have been riots against the possibility of arresting and detaining rapists, alleged rapists, this shows the deep fracture that is in the Israeli society. This is what I've heard calling the boomerang effect of colonization. This is what Israel has inside itself today. Part of the population made of Israeli officials, but also the electorate, which has given them mandate to rule the country, which is significant, who want more and more violence against the Palestinians as Palestinians, because they are Palestinians regardless of what they have done, but just because of who they are. And on the other side, you have a population which is not necessarily pro-Palestinian, but shocked by what's happening, and in fact, realizing that Israel has lost its moral compass, or whatever was its moral compass. And this is the picture I have of the Israeli society at the moment.
And the aftermath of that is that the Israeli military said that it's opened an investigation. We've seen the Israeli army say that before and you know, say that they've opened investigations into certain incidents. I think one of the criticisms that even human rights experts inside Israel say that the army, whenever it opens an investigation and investigates itself, you know, it shows a lack of transparency. So again, how do you react to the idea of this investigation?
I agree with those analysts who have pointed that these investigations are perfunctory and just posturing in the face of the risk of the ICC opening more investigations or bringing charges against more Israeli officials. I do think that the ICC prosecutor's request for arrest warrants against two Israeli leaders has created some anxiety. And therefore, it's better to show that investigations are taking place. This is part of it. I agree with this. I also think that those who signed off the arrest order for the soldiers who had allegedly committed rape against the Palestinian detainee, I have no reason to believe that they didn't do that out of really compliance with the law and out of moral outrage. So I think that there is both of this.
But you do also see the perspective of why some analysts and human rights experts and whatnot basically express doubt or pessimism when these investigations are open, at least.
Of course, and this is not just outlandish speculation. It's proven. Israel has a record of impunity that it's really appalling, because there is 99% documented impunity for cases brought by Palestinians against the Israeli army. And I think the count also includes complaints against armed settlers or violent settlers. There is simply not one person who has been held accountable according to the applicable law. Even the few soldiers who have been held accountable in 56 years of occupation have been released. Even in the case of killing, of videotape killing, as it happened in the case of as it happened in Hebron. There is no accountability. There is not that there is no guarantee of accountability. There is guarantee of impunity. This is documented. Of course, things might change, but in the current landscape or in the current scenario, it's highly unlikely.
I want to move on to a report that you released earlier this year, Anatomy of a Genocide. You declared in that report that there are clear indications that Israel has violated 3 of the 5 acts listed under the UN Genocide Convention. If we take a step back, I mean, other than obviously having this as public record and holding Israel to account, what were your hopes of releasing this report?
An awakening of conscience around member states, among member states, and action. I keep on finding myself very naive, because I do, every time I publish a report, I say, this is going to make a change. And then nothing changes.
This is what goes on in your head prior to releasing the report.
Yeah, I said, when I wrote the report on children, I said, of course they will act. And then there was October 7 and nothing mattered anymore. That report was unfortunate because it was delivered really at the worst possible moment. The attention span for the Palestinians was virtually none, especially among Western countries. But that report is still there, and it is an indictment. Look, if I read my report now in retrospect, self-determination, exposing the mass incarceration system, and or how Israel treats children, I do see a trade union, and I do see that there were clear indications that a genocide, meaning the physical destruction, because this is how genocide is interpreted, the physical, biological destruction of a people, would come sooner or later. It would just, a trigger had to be pulled. And it was the 7th of October. But so, yes, I always have hope that things might change. But of course, there was no political change at all after the release of the report. Although, I do think that I have somewhat contributed to shift the mindset, to shift the mentality around the question. First of all, because the report is solid, it has not been attacked on the substance once, not one of the elements I have produced in the reports. And trust me, I know that my reports are micro-studied when they come out. So I pay attention to every comma, in even the smallest details and footnotes, because I know that I will be held accountable for any possible mistake. And in this on the substance, the report has not been challenged.
You say that the report hasn't been attacked, but I'm sure you've seen this clip when the reporter asked the spokesperson for the State Department about the report. They attacked you. They accused you of anti-Semitism.
Awful, but I mean, we will talk about that. I don't want it to be about me. But the thing is that it has helped shift the mentality. So I notice, and I don't want to say that it's because of me or my work, but I notice the emphasis, for example, on the emphasis on systematic issues that is emerging from other analysts as well. The look at the what I call the humanitarian camouflage, meaning how Israel uses international law jargon to justify the violence against the Palestinians. This is something that somewhat has percolated the debate, and it's or has imbued the debate is there, and it's like my self-determination report. If you look at the documentation that was presented before the International Court of Justice in preparation of the its advisory opinion, it was overwhelmingly relying on my report on self-determination and other reports, of course, by other special rapporteurs and independent experts. So it's helping to shift the discourse. And it's not necessarily acknowledged, because somewhat Israel and its acolytes have managed to create a reputational damage to me as a persona and a mandate holder that is tangible. And of course, it's unfortunate, but it's not new.
Can I ask you about how you felt, again, what was going on through your mind before you gave that speech at the UN following the release of your report? I mean, that speech was clipped up by various news organizations, but again, I want to kind of peel the layers a bit and explore what you were thinking and what you were hoping to do through that speech.
Yeah. Look, I'm, as a human rights lawyer, I find myself having a really thick skin, in the sense I'm not someone who, okay, I can, of course, I'm very passionate about my work and what I do. I'm very committed to justice. But it's very difficult that it's very rare that I'm affected by my work. Writing that report was really painful. And because of the evidence, I had to say there was no possibility for me to turn my eyes away from the horror, the brutality that I've seen human beings enacting. So there was the shock for what was happening to the Palestinians, but also the shock for seeing Israelis doing what they were doing amid the misinformation, the fact that also seeing Palestinians being killed, being brutalized, and then being blamed and being sneered. This has been the prevailing sentiment while I was preparing that report. But before delivering that speech, I felt very emotional. People who have known me for over a decade and were there on that day say, "Ooh, you can also, I have seen your hands are shaking."
They were surprised that you were showing emotion?
Yes, they were. They were, because I'm the kind of person when I'm upset, I'm someone who gets frustrated and expresses her frustration, not necessarily emotions. That day, my hands were shaking because I felt how heavy it was, the message I was delivering, including for many who are really, really impassionately supporters of the state of Israel. I do understand how many people felt outraged by that report, because they do believe that Israel is a democracy behaving according to human rights standards, but it's not. And I'm sorry to be the one destroying the party, but it is what it is. And it's a hard mission to carry and discharge, but it's I have to be the carrier of bad news.
As far as your mandate is concerned, what follows this report? What else can you deliver on?
Of course, I follow up on my reports by interacting with member states. Probably you might have realized that what is clearly different between me and my predecessors is my engagement with the media. I'm very open and accessible to journalists, because I think it's important. There are not many it's not that there are not many voices speaking out on Palestine, but it's very difficult to find people belonging somewhat to the UN system ready.
you're much more recognizable, for sure.
Yeah, but I've made also other special rapporteurs who are equally committed to justice and human rights as I am. I've also managed to make them more visible, because I can tell you, I mean, there is the shock that I experience because of what I'm seeing on an everyday basis is shared among special procedures mandate holders. And I initiate most of the actions concerning Palestine, but they are hugely supported. And there are other actions that are initiated by others on food, health, or countering terrorism. So there is a huge sense that here is not only the life of Palestinians and Israelis at stake. There is the solidity of the international system, which functions as a peace-preserving system only if its rules are respected universally, equally by all, and not, and it cannot be considered, cannot be treated, as my predecessor Michael Link used to say, as a manual act where you can pick and choose what to apply and what not, and whom to apply it to.
Do you think the UN is doing everything possible or everything it can do when it comes to Israel's conformity to international law?
It depends, because the UN, it's a huge system. So the Security Council, absolutely not.
Because of the vetoes?
Yes, because of the US veto. It boils down to that. The Security Council is not effective primarily because of the strength and the paralysis provoked by the US veto, which has always been revolting. But now, at the time of atrocities, is really shameful. And it will be remembered. Eventually, justice knocks at the door of those who have wrongdoings to account for. So, I mean, this is my optimism. I do believe that the US will be judged because of the support they have given to Israel while it was genociding the Palestinians and displacing them from what remains of their land, basically. Then, of course, there is the General Assembly, which is a different reality, which is more democratic. And at the same time, I do not think that the General Assembly is doing enough. First of all, because there are opportunities that have not been seized, like the reactivation of the apartheid committee or the Uniting for Peace resolution that would allow to somewhat circumvent the limitations of the imposed by the Security Council. But also, I do think that member states are not doing enough in collectively and individually. And these are UN member states, so they are part of the system. Why don't they impose sanctions and an arms embargo without a Security Council declaring it? This is something that individual member states or at the regional level could and should do. And then there are, of course, the organizations like the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights or UNICEF and UNRWA. And then it very much depends on the leadership of each organization. There are organizations which are more outspoken, and we have had UNRWA, which is probably the UN agency which has suffered the most pressure and attacks and losses. UNRWA has lost 200 staff members in the past 10 months and undergone really huge challenges in order to stay alive. UNICEF has done an incredible job, and so is WHO. And then there are organizations which are more violent. Again, it depends. But the institutional culture in the UN is to preserve some diplomacy, to respect member states, even when they violate international law. This is something that I find having shown its limits, to say the least.
And the reason why I ask this in the general sense is because even the UN itself has lost over 190 members of its UN staff who have been killed in Israel's war on Gaza. I mean, that's more staff than any other time in the organization's history. So again, it goes back to the question, is there nothing that they could implement? or they could do to try and alleviate some of this?
Look, eventually, without member states' support, there is really little they can do. They can denounce the situation as clearly and explicitly as it's needed. But without political resolve, it's difficult to see any meaningful change. This is the brutal reality. This is the world we live in. But, and again, what discourages me right now is that it's true that the US is a powerful ally on the side of Israel. But I can't believe that it blows my mind that the rest is completely supine in the face of this alliance. So it means that a number of Western countries are fine with what the US and Israel are, how the US and Israel are behaving at the international level vis-a-vis the international system. And also other countries are just indifferent. I mean, the Arab world, this requires its own investigation and its own reflection. A reflection on its own, because it's pretty the silence of many Arab countries and the fact that a number of them maintain cooperation with Israel, even at the time of atrocity, is not normal.
I want to ask you about a quote that really struck me that you said, as you know, for someone who's a legal scholar. You were talking about the implementation of international law, and then you were referring to the Western way of interpreting international law. And then you said this quote. You said, "We force our categories, our pace, our language upon the other." I don't know if you remember this particular quote, but I wanted to see if you can expand on it.
The debate at the scholarly level, at the academic level, the debate concerning the apparent dichotomy between human rights and other values, for example, Asian values or Global South values, is old, so nothing new there. But it's true that the West has been not only the main proponent of the codification of human rights, while I do believe that human rights are the conquest of many, many movements and people around the world, those who fought against the slavery, for gender recognition, or for the rights to food sovereignty, etc. So, but Western states have codified rights and have also used human rights as a sort of a stick or a benchmark against which to measure member states, other states, sort of development. And then they fail so miserably. The human rights test comes to Israel. Again, it's not just Palestine, because if we look a bit deeper, or if we dig a bit deeper, we see that the same kind of the double standards are hypocrisy is evident in the way Western states interact with the Global South. Look at migrants and refugees, how they are treated. It really depends on where they come from, Ukraine versus the rest of the world. This has been quite a telling case of discrimination on the ground of race. The way Ukrainian refugees have been treated, which is great, vis-a-vis how refugees from other parts of the world, primarily the Arab world or Africa, are treated. So this is not unique. At the same time, there is no parallel in recent history of a country that is considered a Western country or very close to the West, which has committed so many violations with impunity and being supported, continue to be supported by most member states in the West. This is quite unprecedented. And this hypocrisy is really putting the validity of the human rights framework to a test.
I also think of one example, and you can tell me if you agree with this or not, but hearing what you're saying I think of when, you know, U.S. officials like Hillary Clinton, for example, or previous officials who've come out and said that on October 6th, you know, there was a ceasefire on October 6th.
But remember, there was a ceasefire on October 6th.
This idea that history, when it comes to Israel-Palestine, started on October 7th and what came after. I mean, is that a correct analogy in reference to what you're saying about the Western implementation of international law?
Partially, indirectly, yes, in the sense that they've really not seen the necessity of applying international law to respect the right to self-determination of the Palestinians. But these denotes, or these is a reflex of another problem, inner discrimination or against the other, which in this case is are the Palestinians. So, the Palestinians are not considered, de facto, are not considered, are not treated as equal. And the proof of it is the fact that I often quote the data, and during 16 months I've been a special rapporteur, over 400 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers or settlers. And 40 Israelis have been killed within the same time frame.
You previously said that there was a risk of genocidal violence expanding to the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not the only one saying that. The Lemkin Institute on the Prevention of Genocide has sounded the alarm months ago, saying it's clear that there is a risk of genocide expanding to the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory. Because of certain features that I'm currently studying, but the level, the arbitrariness of killing, detaining, and detaining Palestinians, the acceleration of the settlement construction and expansions, the robbing the Palestinians of their land and the home demolitions, this has accelerated at the pace that can only be explained as a 360 degrees assault against the Palestinians as a people. Israel doesn't want the state of Israel doesn't want the Palestinians in the land that it believes being of the Israeli Jews only. This has been critically explained by Smotrich, among others, in its 2017 plan, saying the Palestinians have three choices. They can either stay, knowing that they will be subjected to us because they are inferior, or they can go somewhere else, otherwise they will be killed.
I mean, do you think Israel is risking becoming a pariah state?
I think Israel should be treated as a pariah state, because this is what it is. It's a state that practices apartheid. It's a state that has advanced colonialism. The time colonialism was clearly banned and had been won over in most of the world, and because it has really scarred the international system, both in its normative framework component and in terms of effectiveness of its institutions, in a way that it will take time to recover from.
I want to move on to the attacks that have been directed at you. I mean, we were just off camera, we were talking about the last time we spoke 2 years ago. The last time we spoke, I asked you about the attacks back then that were directed against you by Israeli officials. I mean, now there's been, 2 years later, there's been more attacks. But I'm going to read you four headlines, and I want to just get your reaction to them. Here's one. Anti-Semitic UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese banned from Israel. That's the Jerusalem Post. UN official called terror sympathizing anti-Semite by Israeli ambassador as calls grow for her dismissal. Fox News. Contentious UN rapporteur accuses Israel of several acts of genocide in Gaza. Times of Israel. Francesca Albanese must be fired from the UN. an editorial by the Jerusalem Post. I mean, there's others as well that you've seen, I know, but how do you react to all of this?
Part of me would say that this is expected. This is to be expected because anyone who dares criticizing Israel's human rights performance, which is frankly what, for example, independent experts do vis-a-vis states. This is our job. Is attacked as an anti-Semite, as a pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, pro-terrorism, etc. So part of it was expected. I was not expecting this ferocity, though, in the sense I was expecting it from Israel and the significant constellation of pro-Israel so-called non-governmental organizations, but they are clearly governmental organizations that that are present in the UN system as well. But I was not expecting other parts of the international diplomacy to follow, like the US or Germany or France. So yes, I've had some serious clashes with the authorities in the States.
Most recently, it was Linda Thomas-Greenfield who attacked you.
Yes, but I mean, in a way, I despise and resent the reputational damage that they've caused me. But at the same time, I mean, my very mandate, and who I am, the way I interpret it, is a j'accuse. Toward them, I force them to look at themselves in a mirror and see the ugliness of what they are doing and what they have become as members of the international community. Of course, they react violently and they believe that by accusing me, somewhat they will dilute the effectiveness of my messages. So far, it has not happened because I do see that still when I go to the United Nations or when I do meet diplomats behind closed doors, they listen to me and they listen intently. The point is that this is the human rights movement, and which includes independent experts, which is trying desperately and relentlessly to bring justice to Palestine, to Palestinians and Israelis alike, is facing a monumental system of denial and closure. It's like if there was a fortress around Israel, and it's difficult to undo this. But it might take, it's just a matter of time. I really believe that it's just a matter of time. And at the same time, how many people are going to die, how many innocent lives will be taken, will be sacrificed on the altar of politics while there is this adjustment, you know?
Obviously, I'm not taking away from what you just said, but the reason why I'm highlighting it is that maybe a lot of people don't know that your position is actually not a paid position.
Absolutely.
With all of these attacks against you, how do you find the will to continue, especially that it could affect your family members as well, it could affect your children, because this is, you know, very easy stuff to find on the internet.
Of course it does. Of course it does. Look, I wouldn't say it's unbearable because I bear it, but my whole family has paid. I've had to change my family habits because of the threats against me, my children, my husband. My husband has been put under so much pressure for the falsehood that has been spread against him. I mean, and he's a very renowned economist. And of course, everyone had to adapt. And I have young kids, so nothing of this has been pleasant. And at the same time, you know, I've been thinking about that and discussing with my family, shall I stop for the sake of our safety and our sense of security? And we have agreed that no, that we cannot be intimidated. We have decided that I shouldn't change because of this pressure. Rather, the contrary, I have a responsibility to stand even more still and stronger in the face of these attacks. Because I also am looked at not just by those who cannot stand me and my mandate, but by others who need to be inspired, who need to see that it's a moral obligation to stand on the side of justice. And yes, it comes at a cost. It comes at a huge cost. But if we are not keen to sacrifice some of our comfort while another people risk to lose everything, what remains of our humanity? This is what humanity means, is feeling what the other within our human family is feeling and trying to help. So, I mean, again, so this is why I say, yes, it's annoying. It's really annoying to be on the receiving end of this pressure, which is enormous, but it won't change what I'm doing.
And some must wonder, Francesca, you know, being, again, attacked and called things like anti-Semitic or an activist on behalf of the Palestinians and the other labels that they've directed at you. I mean, has that not affected your standing within the UN?
No. Rather the contrary. People wonder about how I managed to stay sane with all this, because it can be really damaging. But my principles are stronger, and I think people respect it. Look, the United Nations know exactly what I'm doing. Some officials might not feel comfortable with it because they are too comfortable with the status quo, because they were too comfortable with the old style apartheid that Israel was embodying, with no one really talking about that. And yes, a couple of reports from independent experts or others being presented and discussed in UN fora. So of course, some can be bothered by how I put myself into the public debate. But as long as I don't break any rules of my code of conduct, I do what I have to do as an independent expert, the beauty of independence.
Has it ever reached the level of death threats?
No.
Yes.
Then you never know how serious they are. So I don't want to know, but I mean, I'm taking precautions.
You are?
Yes, but not obsessively, no.
You never fear for your life, though? It never gets to that level with you?
Not to the point of impairing my life, no. Look, I come from a country where people have paid for their commitment to justice. We have had very well-known judges who were engaged against the mafia and to bring justice to the victims who have lost their life. And the thing is that I would dishonor the memory of these people whom I look at as icons and models. I would dishonor them if I did something differently from what I'm doing, meaning staying put. I need to continue to expose the huge illegality and the huge injustice that the Palestinians are facing, and to an extent, Israelis as well, because I keep on saying, a system where some human beings brutalize and torment other human beings is not just dehumanizing for those who suffer this torment, but also for those who inflict it. Sooner or later, we can come back to that. And actually, I think it has started, because the fact that Israel is now extremists so embedded in a political system that has traditionally been seen as liberal. This is a sign that impunity sooner or later starts to fester inside the system itself.
What has been your experience like with Western and mainstream media? I mean, you've given tens and dozens of interviews, especially over the last year. Maybe hundreds.
Yes, it changes, huh? But there are a few common elements. There are countries like my own country, Italy, where the censorship around Palestine and the self-censorship is unparalleled. I've not seen any other country in other Western countries where there is knowledge of what's going on, and at the same time, there is a conscientious choice not to report on the facts, to keep.
Is this because of the government in place right now in Italy?
Partially because of that, but I think it's also the reflex of long years of disengagement with the question of Palestine, and also the pro-Israel lobby is very strong in Italy. Yeah, I think that these are the major factors. But even with more left-leaning governments, the situation for the past 30 years has been incrementally bad, and I wouldn't say a pro-Israel stance has emerged, because Italy has never been anti-Israel. Italy was historically close to the people of Israel, but not at the expense of the rights of the Palestinian people, and always in defense of the rights of the Palestinians to exist as a people, including to resist as a people, Israel, to resist Israeli oppression. So this is something very important. While now there is an acritical alignment with everything and anything that Israel says, does, and says. And also the Israeli embassy in Italy has been very present in Italian institutional life. And this is something that I know, because people in institutions behind closed doors talk about that. So there is a sense of, again, as I said, of untouchability when it comes to Israel. I've experienced it myself. Also, what is particular in Italy is that, unlike other countries, including in Europe, there are not many progressive Jews who are outspoken and critical of Israel. So it seems that the Italian Jewish community is completely on the side of Israel, whatever it does.
And what about American and other European outlets?
Other countries, it depends. It really depends. In general, I like engaging with the media, even when they come with questions which are not particularly intelligent. I was thinking of all those who have asked me, do you condemn Hamas? Like hundreds of times, probably not hundreds, but dozens of times for the first months. Yeah, of course I condemn. I was not condemning Hamas. I condemn Hamas acts which have harmed civilians by killing, brutalizing, or kidnapping civilians. Of course I do. Why do you ask? But I've never been asked, and I've never heard Israelis being asked, do you condemn what your government or what your army is doing? So this has been really annoying. But other than that, I've enjoyed working I've enjoyed my interaction with the media. What I don't like is not being given space, as it happened in Italy. It's astonishing that they have an Italian speaker, special rapporteur, someone who's been designated as the expert, the independent expert on Palestine at the international level by the UN Human Rights Council, and they never seek her opinions. This is quite bothering. But other than that, it's fine. I mean, it's still an opportunity, even when you have even when you have media who ask clearly biased questions, it's still a good opportunity to raise awareness.
What do you think the media is still getting wrong when it comes to Gaza and the West Bank?
A couple of things. I do see that there are once strongly reputed media who really try the utmost to cover up for Israel's wrongdoings, to alter the reality, and I find it so unethical and unprofessional. So this is clearly wrong, but sometimes they also do not understand, and they do not understand the fact because of an inner bias, of an inner Orientalism, which is an elegant word to say racism. So there is a bit of racism in Western media toward the Palestinians. Of course, I'm brutally generalizing, but this is what I perceive at the mainstream level, for example, in the UK or in the US or in in Italy, in Germany, not in Spain, not in Ireland. So there are exceptions. But it's these are the most important wrongs. And also sometimes they just don't verify the facts. So they report what the Israeli military or the Israeli government say without verifying. And I find it really unprofessional.
What really comes next? I mean, you've been barred from entering Israel, which is a crucial element of continuing your mandate, if I'm not mistaken. You still have a few years left in your position. So what are the next steps that you are hoping to achieve?
I've been officially declared persona non grata by Israel, which makes my life more complicated. But I've never tried to enter Israel since I became a special rapporteur. I demand to be allowed to enter the occupied Palestinian territory over which Israel maintains an unlawful occupation. And it's this unlawfulness cannot be recognized. So I find unacceptable, for example, that I need to seek an Israeli visa in order to be allowed to enter the occupied Palestinian territory. Israel must cooperate with the United Nations or else face consequences. But before me, there was already a de facto ban of special rapporteurs on the occupied Palestinian territory, because in 2008, Richard Falk was detained and deported, and no special rapporteurs has been allowed, and no special rapporteurs on the OPT has been allowed in ever since. So I managed to get that ban all formalized, but it has always been there since 2008.
In the meantime, what else can you do within your mandate?
Of course, I expect to be allowed into the occupied territory. So it's not that I take it as Israel's attitude as immutable. Hopefully it will change in the coming years, so especially because member states will have to come to terms with the ICJ recognition of the legality of the occupation. In the era of technology, and the technology allows us to reach pretty much everywhere, even when our physical body cannot, I've been able to access victims and their legal counsels, huge constituencies of both Palestinians and Israelis, lawyers, human rights organizations, experts. I will continue to hold the consultation with them to receive allegations and submissions, to maintain active engagement with the academia, with Jewish and Palestinian communities outside Palestine, outside Israel. So I will continue to do that, of course. I'll continue my job as I've done so far.
Do you find hope in your job? And I won't ask any more questions, but do you find any hope?
Yeah, of course. Of course. We do not have the luxury not to have hopes until there are lives to be saved. There is something that Marsha Gessen said that touched me very much. She said, the difference between the people in Gaza and the people in the Warsaw Ghetto is that the former can be saved and must be saved, unlike the latter. So until and unless there is one life to be saved and to be protected, I have hope.
And on that note, Francesca Albanese, thank you so much for speaking to us on Real Talk. I appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule. Thank you so much.
Thank you.